We're continuing on in our study of the book of Daniel this morning, and today we're going to be in Daniel chapter 2. Don't know if we're going to get all the way through it. I'm prepared to do that if that's the way it goes, but I'm also prepared to finish up Daniel 2 next weekend and maybe get into 3. Last week we covered Daniel chapter 1. And just as a quick review, we looked at the biblical timeline. We talked about how Daniel fits into that timeline. Mentioned some of the other major and minor prophets that were alive when he was alive and overlapped with him and bookended him on either end. We talked about the sieges of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, and that we think that Daniel chapter 1 opens around the time of the first siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, so that was 605 BC, give or take, that there were two other sieges after that, but generally speaking, that first siege and that first captivity is considered to be the beginning of the Jewish captivity when Daniel and his three friends were taken captive, and they were part of the plunder, if you want to think about it that way. They were actually part of what was taken from Jerusalem. And so Daniel and his three friends arrived in Babylon, and we read how he chose trust in God over what might have put him at risk. Or he trusted in God and did what put him at risk in terms of the laws and the powers of man, rather than succumbing to that. He chose not to defile himself and eat food that was unclean for whatever reason. It could have been that it was offered to idols. It could have been that that food came from animals that were considered unclean under the Jewish law. And we saw that God prospered him, God protected him, and allowed him to be considered 10 times better at the end of that story, along with his three friends and all of the other wise men who were being trained at that time. And so today, we're going to continue on in that study. And I think we're going to build on some of the lessons that we saw from last week. We talked a lot about Daniel's character and how he didn't compromise. He held to his beliefs, he stood on those beliefs, and he trusted that the God that he worshipped was going to care for him and protect him. And that's where he put his trust. And he put his obedience in God above all else. And I think today, again, we're going to see that Daniel puts his trust in God. That's another theme that's going to repeat itself in Daniel chapter 2. I'm going to read the first 11 verses or so of Daniel chapter 2 if you want to follow along. I'm reading from the New American Standard. "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. The king said to them, 'I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream.' Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, 'O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation.' The king replied to the Chaldeans, 'The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation.' They answered a second time and said, 'Let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation.' The king replied, 'I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation.' The Chaldeans answered the king and said, 'There is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Has your knowledge or skill ever been tested on that level? I mean, my kids tell me their dreams sometimes. They cover a wide spectrum. I'm sure yours do too. I've had some pretty vivid dreams, but my kids have never asked me to tell me what they dreamed or dreamt beforehand. Nothing like that. I mean, has your understanding or your ability in some way ever been tested like that? What's the closest? You know, for me, the closest thing I can think of. I've had a few job interviews where they sat me down and needed me to prove that I had the skills necessary to do that job. And in a couple of cases, what that amounted to was me writing software while other people watched and watching me solve the problem. And that's the closest thing I can think of that I've ever come to a test like this, because, you know, they wanted to see, is he going to have to be on Google the whole time? Is he going to be researching things while he's trying to solve this problem, which is frankly a daily event in my line of work? But we've all been put to the test, I think, in different ways. You know, we can be tested. Our abilities can be tested so that whoever's testing us can learn whether or not we are the real McCoy, whether or not we're authentic in what we say we can do. And I think this is a really interesting test that Nebuchadnezzar puts these men to. I see a lot of wisdom in what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. He wants authenticity. He's looking for a real interpretation. And why would he trust the interpretation? Anybody can do that. Anybody can walk up to him and say, that's a really interesting dream. Here's what it means. Here's the meaning that I see in those characters in your dream, in those symbols in your dream. This is what they stand for. Anybody can do that. But Nebuchadnezzar says, well, if they actually have the power to tell me the real meaning behind this dream, clearly he believes this dream is coming from somewhere else. He believes this is an otherworldly message. And so he wants to see the man who tells him the interpretation demonstrate an otherworldly power, right, before he tells him the interpretation, as a litmus test for authenticity. Do you have your hand up?
Okay. Well, yeah. I was going to say, I think it's not just that he's blocked. Like, he's smart and he thinks maybe this would be a good idea. To me, it indicates that perhaps Nebuchadnezzar had experience with his magicians and wise men kind of saying whatever the king wants to hear, and not necessarily having, as you put it, actual knowledge of what should be going on. He just kind of makes something up on the spot. Now he may be saying, I know you guys have been doing that, and I'm not. That's not what I'm looking for.
Sure. If you didn't hear Adam's comment, his point is maybe Nebuchadnezzar has been a king long enough that this isn't his first rodeo with people coming to him, telling him what they think he wants to hear. Right. Tracy? Sure, yeah, Tracy's point was maybe that indicates to us that this dream that Nebuchadnezzar just had was so vivid and so disturbing that he knew offhand that there was a deeper meaning behind it. Yeah, great point. It says in verse 1, his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. I think we've all had dreams where we had trouble going back to sleep, right? Do you have a comment? Okay. So what Nebuchadnezzar is seeking here is truly not of mortal origin, right? It's not an earthly kind of wisdom or understanding that he wants. He wants something beyond that. Any other comments before we read on in this chapter? Yeah.
I think, if I understand the timeline right, this chapter happens in the middle of chapter 1, chronologically, because this is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, But Daniel and his friends, they're tested for what? Is it 2 or 3 years? I can't remember.
3 years.
So it was the first-ish year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign when Daniel and his friends are taken into captivity, and now it's the second year. So Daniel's actually going to be asked to interpret before the end of the chapter 1, where it's said that he has 10 times the wisdom of everybody else.
Yeah, that's kind of my understanding of it too. Adam's point is that if you look at the very first phrase in this chapter in verse 1, this is the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar. That seems to indicate that we may be somewhere in the middle of what happened in the previous chapter. Not 100% sure about that. Last week we talked about how the way a Hebrew might count the reign of a king is a little different than the way a Babylonian would count it. And you can end up with a 1 year difference sometimes. This is the third year versus the fourth year. It's because on the one hand, they're not counting the year in which that king came to power. They're only counting the first full year. I think it's certainly a possibility here that Daniel, this story that we're reading here is not strictly chronological in the book. I'm going to read on in verse 12 for a few minutes. I'm going to go probably through to verse 18, and then we'll discuss for a little while. Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, "For what reason is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, otherwise known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? Here he's referring to them by their new names, the names that were given to them in Babylonian, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So here is the first of several situations we're going to study where Daniel is facing death and he takes courage. And where does he take courage from? His faith. And he turns to his friends and they turn to God in prayer. Notice these two phrases that I have here, these two words in the New American Standard. It says that Daniel, in verse 14, replied with discretion and discernment. What are those two things? What is discretion? Give me an example of when you observed someone else's discretion or when you benefited from someone else's discretion.
Since it's an example of discretion, I don't know that I would share a personal experience. But
we're all benefiting from Adam's discretion.
But it's simply the idea that everyone doesn't need to know or understand what's being discussed or what's going on. So it involves a level of determining what should be shared broadly versus what should be shared privately. And Arioch is coming to kill all the wise men, and perhaps that's what they're having discretion about, is saying, before we broadcast this broadly, you're going to kill everyone. Why don't we talk for a moment?
Yeah, I think it's a good definition, knowing the difference between information that needs to be shared and information that doesn't, right? Sammy? Sure. Need to know basis, right? Yeah. What about, Dwayne?
There's a proverb that says discretion is the better part of valor. So you consider all the circumstances, and according to the wisdom given to you, you pick the most prudent one. But fits both cases here.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the sequence of events here is really interesting because Daniel requests an audience with the king. And then he goes to his friends and he says, I'm about to go talk to the guy in charge about this. I'm about to go talk to the guy who is so fed up with all of the baloney he's getting from Chaldeans and sorcerers and conjurers that he's just decided, kill them all. Which kind of speaks to Adam's point a few minutes ago. I mean, to me, that's further evidence that Nebuchadnezzar is just sick of this. He's sick of being told whatever people think he wants to hear. Maybe he feels like he's being manipulated, and so he's just decided, you know what, I can do without sorcerers, conjurers, and magicians. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point. We're not really sure what else might have come along, right, in the background. You know, there could have been other events that have transpired here where Daniel may have earned a little bit of credibility, Dwayne and then Tracy.
Well, before we throw all these astrologers under the bus, who came from the east seeking the new king, and how they know it? Who Jesus was born.
How did the wise men from the east know?
They are believed to have been Chaldeans.
Right.
Nobody knows for sure. But, you know, they had some perception that was unusual, to say the least. I mean, my opinion is that God revealed that to them.
Right.
But if you reveal that, did he ever reveal anything else? The answer is, I don't know. But it raises the question of possibility or probability.
Okay. Other comments? Yeah.
What is this the first time that someone has asked a wise person to not only interpret the dream, but tell me what I dream?
Well, that's certainly the claim being made by these Chaldeans. They're saying this has never been asked. I don't remember that either. Maybe somebody can jump in, but I sure thought that Pharaoh told Joseph what the dreams had and like what they consisted of. Yeah. But certainly, you know, the Chaldeans are saying, as far as we've known, no king has ever made a request like this. Yeah. So we see here towards the end of this passage that, again in verse 18, Daniel has gone to his friends so that they might request compassion from God, from the God of heaven concerning the mystery. Daniel is asking his friends to pray. There's kind of two levels to that, and as far as I can tell, I mean, obviously Daniel believes in the power of prayer. He has a relationship with his God already. He believes that he can ask his God, our God, for help and receive it. But apparently he also believes that the more people who are praying about this problem, the better. And that's what you and I need to do. We need to recruit each other more often than I think we do to pray for each other. We need to come to each other and say, this is what I'm up against right now. Can you pray about that? You know, what I like is to talk to my kids about those things. Because it hit me not long ago that no matter how I might feel about myself and my own relationship with God, I've got a few completely innocent, pure hearts under my roof who can pray to God for you and for me. And I know that God is listening to them still. And just think about that this week. You know, think about recruiting some of your brethren to pray for you, like Daniel did. Because it's not just praying like Daniel did, it's thinking about prayer the way Daniel did, I think. Yeah.
One thing I just think is interesting is, I think Daniel is hopeful. He has faith in God that God will answer him. But when Daniel tells Arioch, or asks Arioch for an audience with the king, he really doesn't know if by the time he gets to the king, he's going to have that interpretation. So in some ways, it's not just, I don't think it's just faith in God that gives him the confidence to do that. I think it is natural wisdom to say, I may have a path to resolve this issue. Will you give me a chance? It may pan out, it may not pan out, but me and my friends and all the wise men in Babylon won't be any worse off. We'll be just as dead if I don't have an interpretation by then.
Yeah.
So I'm going to appeal to God. It's kind of a certainty of my appeal to God is necessary, but that doesn't mean I'm certainly going to have an answer, if that makes sense. Might as well try.
So you're saying he's not necessarily counting on getting an answer.
Well, I mean, I think he has faith in God that it'll happen, but I think we read this with the certainty of having already read the rest of the chapter. But if you think about when Daniel talks to Arioch in the middle of the chapter, the only thing Daniel has is faith that God will answer.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of what I was getting at earlier when I pointed out the sequence here. I think I agree with what you're saying. He's tapping all available resources, right? I think he's a man of great faith and great trust I think he is hoping, and I think he's believing that God is going to help him in this case. I don't know if I'm... What's that? Yeah, I think so. It could be that him going to Arioch, it's the way this is written. I don't know if the sequence that it's written in the book is really chronological, but it could be that he's gone to Arioch before Arioch starts killing people, like Adam pointed out a minute ago. Like, whoa, 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 you know, give me a few minutes. Yeah. Yeah, you would think. Can't imagine being in that position either. Okay, well, I'm going to read another five verses or so, continuing on in verse 19. I think we're doing pretty good on time. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." Just for a second, think about Daniel the writer, okay? Not Daniel the prophet or Daniel the wise man, but think about Daniel the man that wrote this down so that people after him could read it. We don't even know what the vision means yet. We don't know what the vision is, and we don't know what it means, and we don't know how this story plays out. And we're not going to find out until we finish reading the thanksgiving that Daniel gave to God for giving him the meaning of the vision. I love that. I love that thanksgiving comes now. Maybe I'm injecting significance into this that's not really there. But the point I'm trying to make is that Daniel gave thanks when he received his answer, when he received his help. Maybe you guys are different than me, but I don't always get that right. I pray a lot when I feel like I need God's help for something. And sometimes when I get it, I'm ashamed and embarrassed later when I realize how long it took me to say thank you, to put just as much time and energy into a prayer of thanksgiving as I did for all my cries of help. And I'll please, please, please. And then everything works out just fine. Everything went better than expected. And how long does it take me to say thank you? Way too long, sometimes. But what I think is that Daniel, who wrote this account, wrote this so that everybody after him could know what happened. This was recorded for all time thanks to the enduring nature of the scripture. We've talked about that. But he could have just left this out. He could have left out the prayer of thanksgiving, but we get this prayer of thanksgiving, and we get it before we learn the rest of the story, for whatever that's worth. It adds, significance and depth to my study of this book, and I hope it does to yours. Continuing on in verse 24, "Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king.' Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, 'I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king.'" There's good news. I don't have to kill everybody, King Nebuchadnezzar. I can't even imagine the amount of relief that this man is feeling at this point. "The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, 'Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?' Daniel answered before the king and said, 'As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind.'" Okay, we still don't know what the vision consisted of or what its meaning is. But we see where Daniel is giving the credit, right? Now, here's a question for you. Do you think that Daniel is doing that of his own accord? Is Daniel telling the king up front before he delivers the meaning and the nature of the vision and the interpretation of it, that it's not him that has the power to do this, but he's getting it from God? Is he telling that by virtue of his own character? Or are those God's words coming out of him? Does that make sense, Dwayne? Sure. Yeah, Dwayne's point is this is an example of Daniel's humility. Daniel is the conduit, right, through which this message is being delivered to King Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel's not looking to get any credit for the fact that he was picked as the conduit. He doesn't make really anything of his own wisdom or understanding. Yeah, Donna? Yeah. That could very well be. Donna's point was Daniel's demeanor here may be very different than the average conjurer or magician who wants the personal credit for being able to work out what that vision meant. Jen?
Given the nature of the interpretation,
right, okay, great point. So we're about to find out what that message is. Maybe it's not such a great message. Maybe it's not something the king wants to hear. And there might be an incentive for the prophet to go, just the messenger. Just don't shoot the messenger. Right? So the next section, verses 31 through 45, is Nebuchadnezzar's dream and its interpretation. And I'm going to go, this is kind of a long passage, but I'm going to go ahead and read all the way through it. You, O king, beginning in verse 31, you, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. There are a lot of artistic renditions of this statue out there. I picked this one because I thought it was the most straightforward. It kind of gets the point across, I think. But there's one artist's idea of what this statue might have looked like to King Nebuchadnezzar. So we've got the head of gold, and then the chest and arms of silver, and the thighs of bronze, and then the legs of iron, and then the feet of iron mixed with clay. Have you ever had a dream like that? When I say like that, I mean a dream that has such specific contrasting details in it. It kind of makes you wonder, what corner of my brain did that come from? You know, what happened to me in the last week that was left over up here that just needed to get out while I was asleep? I've wondered that sometimes, but I've never had a dream quite like that. And clearly this is not something that anybody could luck into. I mean, Daniel can't take a wild guess and go, I think it was about a statue. It was made of four materials. So Nebuchadnezzar has received the authentic telling of his dream that he's looking for. Continuing on in verse 36, Daniel says, this was the dream. Now I will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. What does that tell you about King Nebuchadnezzar's empire at this time?
Great.
It's great. It's the empire. As far as Daniel is concerned, as far as the one that God has chosen to reveal this, Nebuchadnezzar is the world power at this point.
He's also reminded that God gave it to him. David says, the God of heaven gave you.
Yeah, that's a great point. In verse 37, he says, you're the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom. So Nebuchadnezzar now knows that he is the head of gold in this statue. Continuing on in verse 39, after you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. Then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron and the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy." Okay, so there's something that's a little bit different about this prophecy than a lot of other prophecies that you and I could study. And it works to our advantage. What do you think is different about this prophecy so far? Sure, so the conclusion of this prophecy makes it a messianic prophecy, right? Because we think, I'm going to get to that, but the stone that's carved out without hands and crushes the statue seems to be symbolic of Christ, or the kingdom of Christ, Adam and then Jen.
I think one of the things that's unique about it, and this is true of many of the prophecies in Daniel, is it's like really easy to put it up against historical events and go, well, yeah, the kingdom of gold is that, the kingdom of silver
sure.
is that, oh, there's the thighs of bronze. This all really makes sense, and I don't have to like work really hard to force to understand this in
yeah.
historical context, like the opposite of Revelation.
Okay, yeah, so Adam's point was it's not a real challenge if you know the sequence of kingdoms historically to try to pair these up. And we're given the first one. We're told that the head of gold is Nebuchadnezzar. So we know that the head of gold is Babylon. Jen? Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of what I was getting at, is I think we're given enough information in this prophecy to work out the identity of these four symbols without too much trouble. And the traditional understanding of that is that the head of gold is Babylon. We're told that one. Medo-Persia would follow after Babylon, so that's the chest and arms of silver. Greece would be the world power that comes along after that. That's the legs of bronze. And then Rome would be the empire that is strong like iron, but at the same time, it's diverse. It's mixed in with other influences and other races and other nationalities. It's kind of a kingdom of kingdoms. And I think as I read this description, verses 40 through 43, the description here is kind of, it's to me, it's as specific to Rome as Isaiah 51 is to Christ. You can read it and go, well, that fits perfectly. That fits perfectly with Rome, especially talking about how it's strong and yet it's brittle. The Roman Empire was spread so far and so wide, it had trouble maintaining its own borders. It had trouble maintaining its line of kings. Dwayne?
Stronger in the legs than it was in the feet.
Stronger in the legs than in the feet, Rome was?
The legs of iron and the feet mixed with iron and clay. And my understanding, as feeble as it might be, and I'm forgetful, but the iron and clay mixture was when the rivalry came in Rome between opposing ambitious men who would be Caesar, and so there was the division at its end before it totally collapsed.
Okay, so in that analogy, if this statue is like a timeline from the head to the toes, then the toes are sort of towards the end of that sequence of time, and the legs are kind of what happened before that. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
So the stone developed.
Yeah, that's also a great point. I find it really, really fascinating, because this statue is almost a cipher for some other prophecies that we'll study later in the class. And it's because of the what I called in the first class the extreme precision, really not what I called, but what other people have called the extreme precision of Daniel's prophecies, that we can think about that and look at it that way. If like Adam said, if only all the numbers and symbols in Revelation could be handed to us with a legend to tell what each symbol stands for, like this, it might be easier to understand. But I think there is some information here in this prophecy that's going to help us understand Revelation a little bit better. Okay, so this might be a good point to, you know, have any final comments or questions, and then we might spend next week focusing more on this stone that's cut out. I think we all know where that's going, right? Maybe because we've studied this before, maybe because we've read our New Testaments, maybe a little bit of both. Yeah.
I do think it's interesting when you look at history. So Daniel gives this prophecy here, and then effectively you have the same prophecy in more detail later, right? And there's one massive kingdom right after the other. And actually they get broader in scope, even though they may not be as strong.
Right.
But then, and we'll talk about this next week, as you said, the mountain comes. And this, from a historical standpoint, after Christ comes, the Roman Empire in some ways fizzles pretty quickly, and then it's really 800 or 900 years before there's another massive kingdom or empire in that same part of the world. It's just interesting to think about the historical context of empire after empire rises and rises and rises. Christ comes and in some ways emphasizes the kingdom that Christ establishes, and it's a long time before men kind of make a comeback with an empire.
Yeah, I think definitely one of the messages of this prophecy is maybe the futility of the kingdoms of men. And that's a theme that, you know, we're all looking for, right, in this study, is that God rules in the kingdoms of men. I think that's actually the subtitle of one of the commentaries I have by Harkwriter, is Daniel, God rules in the kingdoms of men. That's a reoccurring theme. And the coming of this new kingdom, you know, like Adam pointed out, kind of proves that. Because if you look at history, there's a pretty big gap between these kingdoms that were so far-reaching. And, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm not as good enough of a history student, but I don't know if there's ever been a single world empire after Rome that both had the power of Rome and also covered as many square miles of the earth as Rome does, or Rome did. I mean, you could probably debate that, but...
Somebody might argue that the British had the rule of those kingdoms had over palm and pine.
Yeah. Well, they even had power in the oceans, too. Well, I appreciate everybody's... Yeah, definitely. I appreciate everybody's comments and questions this morning. I'm excited that we're studying this. I think we're going to pause here. Next week we'll pick up with some discussion of this rock that's hewn and thrown at the statue. Then we'll get into chapter 3.